beautiful day, and just another day in the work on hand. And this morning, we would want you to listen carefully to our opening comments, which are taken from the quotation book by H.P. Blavatsky. In her words, for today, May 20th. A thorough familiarity with the occult faculties of everything existing in nature, visible as well as invisible, their mutual relations, attractions, and repulsions. The cause of these traced to the spiritual principle which pervades and animates all things. The ability to furnish the best conditions for this principle to manifest itself. In other words, a profound and exhaustive knowledge of natural law. This was and is the basis of magic. And this was taken from Isis Unveiled, first edition, page 244. Need time to think about those words as we introduce a short talk on the aim and purpose of our coming together every Sunday for talks and discussions. As you see, we started promptly at 11 and we'll be finished by noon. Doors opened at 10:30. Today, May 20th, the topic, the pitfalls of psychism. And every Sunday we have a program, talk, panel, forum, and we welcome you every Sunday morning, 11 a.m. to noon, for these talks and discussions. Now every Wednesday, the doors open at 5:30 so that you can come in and visit our library. It's a reference library, and in there you will find straight line theosophical literature plus other valuable documents and tomes, if you say so, in that library to help you prepare for that particular lesson that night, or even to do some research on your own. That library closes at 7:30, and you have just a little while, about 15 minutes, to examine the books on the book table, straight line theosophical literature. Can you imagine? Stretching back to 1875 and forward, plus other supporting literature. These books, these pamphlets, are available at very, very reasonable prices. And we recommend, if this is your first visit, that you ask for Theosophy Simply Stated, which is a pamphlet, which will give you an introduction to the three fundamental propositions based on those principles, called the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy. This week, we continue in The Ocean of Theosophy, book by William Q. Judge. We're about the 17th chapter, going into the 18th. If you do not have that volume, or if you do, we recommend that you go to the introduction in that little book and reread it as we come toward the end of the study in the Ocean of Theosophy. Now the study class begins, as we said, at 7:45. It's over at 9. It's a joint effort, and everyone, visitors and regular attendees, chair by asking questions, making comments on the literature available. The volunteers are just ordinary citizens from all walks of life. No personalities are involved, and we wish you to listen to what is said rather than to the one saying it. We do our best as volunteers, of course. Your attention. This is the part of the declaration that helps to explain our purpose. It's a declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race or creed or sex or condition or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. If after attending these classes over a period of time, and you wish to participate, like so many of us, there's a form that you will find at the desk and a volunteer to explain it to you. It states, being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge, as set forth in its declaration, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate. It being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine independently. Before we begin talk this morning, we were given a reading from the Bhagavad Gita. It's in the second chapter, and Arjuna speaks. What, O Kashyapa, name of Krishna, is the description of that wise and devoted man who is fixed in devotion, in contemplation, and confirmed in spiritual knowledge? What may such a sage declare? Where may he dwell? Does he move and act like other men? A man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entereth into his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self through the self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity. He is happy and contented in prosperity. And he is a stranger to anxiety and fear and anger. Such a man is called a Muni. When every condition he receives, each event, whether favorable or unfavorable, with an equal mind, which neither likes nor dislikes, his wisdom is established, and having met good or evil, neither rejoices at the one nor is cast down by the other. He is confirmed in spiritual knowledge when, like the tortoise, he can draw in all his senses and restrain them from their wanted purposes. The hungry man loseth sight of every other object but his gratification of his appetite. When he has become acquainted with the Supreme, he loses all taste for objects of whatever kind. The tumultuous senses and organs hurry away by force the heart even of the wise man who striveth after perfection. Let a man restraining all these remain in devotion at rest in me, his true self. But he who hath his senses and organs in control possesses spiritual knowledge. Thank you.
We picked that reading because, especially for the last, basically the last sentence, about having one's senses and organs under control. Because in regards to psychism, we are looking at getting our senses under control. And we will go into that a little more deeply as our talk goes on. The overall umbrella topic for this month has been psychism and spirituality. And it's kind of interesting. It's like, why are the two of them, why are we looking at both of them this month? We started out with White Lotus Day, which is a commemoration of the life and work of H.P. Blavatsky. And she's the one that put forth these teachings that she had gotten from her masters about psychism and spirituality. So we kind of got the background of how we got this information on May 6th. And last week we talked about meditation in daily life, and we're looking at meditation as developing our spirituality. And actually we will be going into meditation again, but in a different aspect during this class. And today we are looking at the idea of the pitfalls of psychism. The Theosophical Glossary defines psychism as a term now used to denote very loosely every kind of mental phenomena, such as mediumship, the higher sensitiveness, hypnotic receptivity, inspired prophecy, simple clairvoyance in the astral light, and real divine seership. In short, the word covers every phase and manifestation of the powers and potencies of the human and divine souls. So we are actually going to be looking at, when we talk about duality, we're going to be looking at both the higher idea of psychism, as well as the title for this class, The Pitfalls of Psychism. So one thing that that definition really didn't go into, and since it was just a simple definition, we wouldn't expect it, there are powers that lie dormant in us all. We all have these powers to some extent. And the philosophy says that if we didn't have at least a little bit of these powers, we really wouldn't be able to communicate with each other. The whole idea of, body language, facial expression, it's an intuition that we develop over time from a child that we can tell how somebody is. And it's almost as if somebody's upset, we can almost feel that tension that is going through them. And this, in some respect, is is a psychic power that just part of what we have. So there are levels of this development of psychic powers. And the idea of having psychic powers without a philosophical basis, without the knowledge of how these powers came about and what they are, is irresponsible psychism. Whereas we need, and we'll go into this more, we need study, we have to work for others, and there has to be a devotion to the higher life in order for these psychic powers to be developed in the proper way. And there's also a warning that the philosophy puts forth of these psychic forces and what they can do if one is not properly prepared, if one does not have this knowledge and the philosophy that is the basis for these psychic powers. Because we can look, if somebody does exhibit some psychic powers and they're looking at certain things, how can they really understand what it is that they're looking at if they don't have this knowledge? So we have to understand then, in regards to psychic powers, that it is intimately involved with the sevenfold nature of man, specifically the astral. And we understand that there are the three higher permanent aspects of human nature, meaning the mind or manas, that buddhi principle, which is intuition, and atma, which is the spiritual side, the spiritual soul. And then the lower four, which are transient, we have the body, we have the astral, and we have prana, and then the passions and desires, and these dissolve with each life, and we get a new set in the next life. But these the psychic powers depend upon also karma, whether we are going to be using them, if we're going to be aware of them, if there's going to be a block to the use, everything depends on karma. So as we progress then, we are looking at the development naturally. We are not forcing this development of these higher powers. They have to come naturally along with our progression. And we do want to go into a little bit of the astral, because it's the astral that is the main principle that is involved with psychic powers. And as we said, it has to be a mindful usage. It cannot be forced. And as we know, the astral body is the model for, it's the design body for our physical frame. And one of the things that it does is that it takes the jiva, or the universal energy, and focuses it into each individual human form. And all the senses are contained in the astral body. And there are two. There's the inner astral senses that are the true senses, and then there is the physical that we are all aware of. And what happens initially is that these two are together, you know, during our regular daytime functioning. And with all the distractions and with the physical form, depending upon how functional that is, all of this kind of overrides the inner usage of these the astral senses. But as we progress, and we thought this was very interesting in our studies, is that as we progress and we meditate, we try to function and we try to focus, you know, on an inward spiritual experience. And as we do more for others, we understand universal brotherhood, we study, there is a slow parting of the ways, so to speak, of the astral senses, the inner ones from the physical ones. And when we're asleep, this is when these inner senses are able to function freely on their own, but not when awake, as we had just stated. So the more we study, the more we aim for a higher life, these senses separate, and then at one point, and this is only when we're, you know, an adept or a master, then there's two sets, and the higher set then is able to function with these psychic powers safely, because at this point there is knowledge of how they work. So this is, at this point then, we are looking at, well, what happens if these psychic powers are forced? What happens when they're not fully separated and somebody is trying to perform these psychic acts? Well, one of the things that they talk about is when, especially a medium during a seance, is not functioning mindfully, they usually have to go into a trance. And at this point, those astral senses are still together. But since this person does not have the knowledge of how to function and they aren't separated, this is quite a stress on the human form. And it is said that many of these mediums, especially since they're asking for money, which we understand kind of adds more of a negative aspect to using these psychic powers when one isn't ready. So some mediums becoming mentally unstable. Physically, their form is very weak and they are sickly. And also many seem to have epilepsy as well when these psychic powers aren't used correctly. And the ability to read people's minds. And if somebody is able to do that, even the adepts and the masters won't read somebody's mind, because that is considered an affront to that person's being. So it's almost like being a thief. One is stealing somebody's, you know, looking in and reading somebody's thoughts. It's like you're stealing their, you know, their mind almost. So we're looking at karmic results then as well, if somebody is using these powers and they're not ready. And that is something that they may even bring forward and probably will bring forward into a future lifetime, is the use of these powers when they're not ready. So So in other words, then, we are looking at pursuing our spiritual journey in a mindful way. It is important that we be aware of others, that we are all part of that deific principle, that we all have our own paths to go, that karma is involved not only with us personally, but bringing people to us for a reason. So we need to look at, we need to be mindful of how our lives are progressing. Meditating, concentrating, and doing our duty. I mean, these are the things that will prevent us from incurring karmic debt if we use these psychic principles before we're ready. One of the things that we love is seeing the sacred in the mundane, and that helps to develop our intuition because we are looking forward into another aspect of what it is that we are doing. It is making us mindful. So we are looking in our evolution that all of these powers will be a normal development, and they won't be forced, because that is what will give us, that will get us in trouble. And we would like to end, you know, there are some things that we come across that we just cannot put into our own words. And one of them is HPB, and it's from her five messages. Psychism, with all its allurements and all its dangers, is necessarily developing among you, and you must be aware lest the psychic outruns the monastic and spiritual development. Psychic capacities held perfectly under control, checked and directed by the monastic principle, are valuable aids in development. But these capacities running riot, controlling instead of controlled, using instead of being used, lead the student into the most dangerous delusions and the certainty of moral destruction. And we think that that reading from the Gita of what a Muni or what an adept is perfectly fits along with this, because it is when all those psychic developments are, you grow into them rather than the, as we've been saying, being forced, because it says the certainty of moral destruction. So if these are used before one is ready, not only are there physical issues and karmic issues, but, and especially again, if money is involved, that moral destruction then is a certainty. So one thing we do want, now we're not even going to touch on this because it could be a whole class in itself. In ISIS, HPB has, and if anybody's interested, I have the volume and the page numbers. It's what they're calling the 10 items, the ABCs of occultism. And it's very interesting, and it does a lot of explaining what some of these issues we just touched upon. So if anybody's interested after the meeting, we can give that to you. So does anybody have any questions? Yes.
We're wondering what it is about paying for this service, we'll call it a service, to have a reading done or channeling or whatnot. We remember not too long ago in this city, all of a sudden all the psychics were shut down, and then, but they were allowed to reopen. Do you think the government, do you think if it's really that dangerous, the government should be involved in shutting these places down? But what is it about, that's kind of a side issue maybe, but the main question is, what is it about money that taints? Why is it tainted by money?
So what is the idea about money that not only taints the psychic powers, so to speak, but really of anything, money and paying for something, we're looking at it as being of a lower, maybe the passions and desires, that it's greed, that you're, it's a, if one surely has a developed gift and they're giving it away, there's more of a give and take between that person and the receiver. Whereas if money is involved, there's a greed aspect to it, because you're paying for something that is part of you or should be part of you. Whereas with money, we think it's just of a lower nature. And if somebody else wants to add to it, it's a big subject. Yes?
Just to clarify, though, we think what's meant there is to charge money, such as a psychic or a medium would, for some type of reading, the indefinite use of those powers by the medium for a potentially selfish purpose. Mm-hmm. Which is different from somebody who in this life may be have natural psychic gifts and happens to be a merchant in a store. And they're selling their goods and services, but they can't help but have an intuitive understanding of their customers because of that. So in charging money for those foods and services, they're not charging for that gift. That's just part of their makeup that they're using to help others.
Right, thank you. And that would be a nice extra service that a merchant could give to someone. Yes, right here.
But in this case, we don't think that it's anything different than what we experience every day, that we meet people who are psychic or sensitive to our needs, and we're sort of connecting that person. But this is that same psychism that was just mentioned.
Because it's interesting, especially if somebody knows a person for a long time, and we think that at some point you're going to know exactly, and it's kind of scary, especially if you're married to that person, and you can, you know, almost read their minds, you know, finish the sentence. And we think that there are some people that, you know, they can anticipate what somebody's needs are before that person even expresses them. And whether that be a doctor, a nurse, even a waitress, we all know of wait staff that just know, you know, like you're going to want extra napkins or salt and pepper or whatever, that they just know. And we think that is maybe not a psychic gift, but we think that it certainly is a more evolved part of their personality. In the back.
As far as being grateful to the merchant, not if you're on a budget.
Mm.
And the other thing, the philosophy clearly states that if money is involved with anything spiritual, it becomes sorcery. Mm. So there are those, we assume, who innocently sell their gifts, and it's not for greed, it's to support themselves, and their karma would not be as difficult as someone who is doing it for greed. But we're not allowed to make money that way. Those powers and that wisdom belongs to all of us freely.
That one thing that was just brought up is that whole idea of motive, because if in regards to the money issue, as was just said, if the motive is to make money, that taints the whole idea. But if the idea, motive colors everything, and we're looking at our motive, as the Gita says, that we shouldn't be looking for the results of our actions. We should, as was mentioned in our talk, duty. We're doing these things because it's our duty, because it has come to us because of something we have done in a past life. Yes?
Well, in the 19th century, there was a period called the Romantic Age in music. that we're sitting down and someone is beginning a Beethoven sonata, or we're listening some of the romantic music, viola, viola, whatever, and we sit down and we're moved by what we are listening to. Is that a form of psychism?
The question having to do with the idea of if we are being moved by a piece of music, is that psychism? And we don't think it's psychism per se. We do know that music being sound, that sound, it's vibration, and we know that there's a connection with this vibration because all is electric, all is vibratory. So we think that there's some kind of a connection there. And we've all experienced where there has been some kind of music, and it doesn't necessarily have to be just classical music, where there's a feeling inside that we resonate to. If somebody wants to a comment, we don't think that that is psychism per se, but there is some kind of an electrical magnetic attraction in the back.
Another way of describing psychic is the feeling nature. So of course music arouses the feeling nature, negatively and positively, mm-hmm. but there's a big difference between the feeling nature and the use of our inner powers. So we agree it isn't psychism per se.
Thank you. Yes.
We don't really define psychism as such. I mean, we're talking around, and the psychism that I think is so dangerous is if you are looking for powers to read somebody's mind, to predict the future, to know something about somebody else, or even about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not prepared, you can unleash some very strong powers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the literature is full of the sorcerer who has not been properly trained, and opens the book of sorcery and casts a spell and unleashes demonic powers, doesn't know how to shut them off. That is the real danger of psychism.
Yes.
That most of us are not prepared for those very strong powers.
Especially during seances, any kind of passivity in general. It could be somebody who just sits in front of the TV hour after hour after hour and just lets their mind roam. And especially in seances, there can be those malevolent entities out there that are just looking for somebody else to attach to. Yes?
In that reading you gave from the address, the American Theosophists, where P.B. says that psychism would naturally be developing
mm-hmm.
in America's 20th century, she did not necessarily mean that kind of specific psychism, but certainly a tendency towards passivity, susceptibility, all sorts of mental and nervous diseases
mm-hmm.
related to that kind of sensitivity would be coming forth. And the very fact that our scientists are seriously investigating these things right now means that it's much more apparent in society than it was years ago.
Yes, and we've all heard on the news when somebody has run amok and has, you know, done killings or explosions or whatnot, and the neighbors will say, gee, you know, he was always such a quiet person. You know, he kept to himself, and he never really talked with anybody, but we didn't think he would do something like that. And we just wonder then, you know, is this one of those instances where, yeah, maybe he wasn't, you know, talking with anybody because he was parked in front of his TV all day. So we don't know, but definitely those things are definitely happening. Yes. Yes.
It's our understanding, though, during the week when we're studying in the ocean about the sevenfold nature of man, we refer to a particular principle, which is called the balance principle, with the statement that man can move himself in either direction, higher or lower.
Mm-hmm.
So the comment on psychism, we think, as was stated, in reference to this particular period of time in our lives when we're bombarded by things that appeal to that lower psychic nature. But we do have a higher one.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that when the public understands the sevenfold nature of man, they will be able to determine how to respond responsibly to what comes after.
Well, the reading that was done that we gave on psychism, it says you must be aware lest the psychic outruns the monastic and spiritual development, which is exactly what the comment is about, is that if we do approach the psychic capabilities from our lower nature, and not from the higher mind and spiritual, that's when somebody's going to run into problems, because at that point, if they're looking at it from the passions and desires or lower mind issues, then that's when we're looking at forcing those psychic principles rather than letting them evolve naturally. In the back.
And there's a statement that it says, once the door is open, it's very difficult to shut it. And it can come later on in your life and pick up again.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that idea of going out into an area that is technically not really safe. There's a lot of forces and energies around us.
Yes, the comment being that once that door is open, if we are mixing in things that we shouldn't be mixing in, that it's almost impossible to close it. So we have to be careful then about how we go about developing these powers. In the back.
The statement about epilepsy,
mm-hmm.
Psychics and mediums can be epileptic, or is this something that is carried over from a past life, that an epileptic was probably a medium in some former life, and now this is manifesting as a nervousness in the constitution? Or both?
We were just going to say both,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, karmically we don't know what's going on with somebody. So we don't know if what they're bringing forward is a development of that lifetime or something that they have brought with them. So, but we do know that one of the pitfalls of using this forced type of psychism is that there are nervous and medical disorders that come about from it. So we think it could be both. Yes.
A comment was made before about should the government get involved with the psychic powers. In a sense, they already are. You know, there have been some popular TV shows on the use of mediums,
mm.
and, or psychics rather, to help solve crimes for police, but also there have been training of armed forces to psychics to detect submarines and mines in fields.
Mm.
So they recognize that these powers exist and they can be trained. So it's interesting that in the philosophy, the conscious development of these powers for selfish purposes
mm-hmm.
is one of the hallmarks of this dark iron age that we live in, and it's only going to get worse. Perhaps it's a carryover from our past.
One thing that we want to add to that is it does say in the literature that even masters and adepts, when they're talking about precipitation and that what they cannot move, we know that, we can't remember the name of it, the power to moving one thing.
Teleportation,
where that moving an item from one place to another. Thank you. Telekinesis. And we know that the adepts know and they will not try to do this with an animal or a human because the development is just so much more involved. But we heard recently about the Philadelphia experiment when talking about the government being involved, where supposedly there was a ship that was transported from, we think it was the East Coast, to Philadelphia to Norfolk, but that the people that were involved on that ship, some of them died and some of them went crazy. So it was interesting that we were just studying this when that whole idea of the Philadelphia experiment came up, because there's the proof right there that you can't do a human safely. But we just thought it was just kind of an interesting, you know, idea where the government is or was getting involved with these sorts of things. Yes?
What we thought you were going to say was that the adepts won't exercise their power in that way because they realize that because of this law of karma and balance, that for every exercise of psychic power in a positive direction, it causes a reaction in the negative. So that they have to be very careful and selective and controlled even in their use of these abilities.
Thank you. In the back?
As far as we know, there is no actual proof about the Philadelphia experiment. There are sources about it, but it isn't proof.
Oh, thank you, that there wasn't any proof about that. Okay. And you've had your hand up? Excuse me.
Yes, thank you. Am I right on thinking here, listening, that theosophy would say there is a psychic pitfall when we attempt to, different individuals do this for money, regressing people to past lives and curing them of a terrible phobia or a fear? Would theosophy say that we're on shaky ground here and playing with something that we really should not be delving into?
Well, the whole idea of the past life regressions is that, and if somebody is cured of, say, the fear of water, the issue comes in is that it's almost, well, it is. It's like you are dabbling in somebody else's karma, that it is better for that person to face that fear themselves in this present life and overcome the issues that brought them there, because karmically that fear, that concern or whatever has been brought to them, and they need to look at it and deal with it on their own. It's their lesson. So that if somebody was regressed back to a past life and then they realize then what it was, and they're not fulfilling that karmic debt that they have. So in regards to past life regressions, it we would say that it's better for you to deal with that issue now on your own. It really doesn't matter if it's from a past life what the reason was. It is an issue you have to deal with now. Yes?
We understand the warnings of dabbling in past life regressions, but this bit about the person has to deal with it on his own. I mean, if a four-year-old child is abused and realizes, you know, all these problems in life by the time they're 30, it's because of the abuse. You know, would a psychologist say, well, you have to deal with that on your own, I'm not going to help you?
Well, the phrase that we use with deal with it on their own is that they have to deal with it in this life, that being regressed is not the way to go. Well, we know that if somebody had something happen to them as a child, of course they're going to need to have maybe some child psychology, or you know, maybe off and on throughout their lives, or if there's abuse there, that things have to be. But when we were saying on their own, we meant that it was something that in a past life, that it's not an issue for them, that they have to know what the reason was now. So it was, you know, a wrong choice of words. Yes?
So then the suggestion is that whatever the issues are that we have to solve within ourselves in this life, whether it's from earlier in this life or even in previous lives, that there are certain principles that we can follow without dabbling in the psychism. That
yes.
Are going to help us work through the problems and grow from them.
Yes, and even if you are working with a psychologist or a psychiatrist on issues that you're having, you still have to rectify all those things on your own, because a doctor or a psychologist can suggest anything. But if you don't choose to follow those directions, that's on you. So in that case, dealing with it on your own, you are. I mean, you could have assistance and direction, but it's on you to whether you're going to follow it up or not. Yes.
Once again, regarding the past life regressions, if we were intuitive enough to understand what we might have done in the past to get us into this trouble we're in now, there's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, that would be a great aid to dealing with it on our own right now. The problem is the method of the trance, of the past life regression, which is a psychic technique of hypnotic trance, which maybe provide useful information, might provide erroneous information, and it may induce a permanent condition of sensitivity in the individual, which could open up more problems for them. So that's part of the objection to that.
Oh, thank you. The whole idea that if somebody does work on an issue because of a past life regression, that may be something that might be more permanent in future lives to come. And we forgot what we were going to say. In the back.
But there, again, proof that someone can say to you, this is your past life I'm seeing, and this is the problem. You have no proof that's so. It could be their imagination. It could be your own imagination that they're picking up on. The fact is, if we take what HPV said, use monastic and spiritual principles. You have a problem? What would be the logical cause? And you would try to work from that basis. But it's just like if you spill something in the kitchen, you don't stand there and go, now how did I spill that? You set about cleaning up the mess, and maybe you'll think about it later. I should move that chair, it tripped me. The important thing is to deal with the issue, as you said, and not try to deal with the past.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, you had your hand up a couple times.
I just want to say a word for self-empowerment. And it really agrees with what you said about motivation. Some of the things Dr. Levy said. My understanding is that we all have these psychic powers latent within us. it isn't a matter of, I think we have to be careful not to think of them as something before which we are helpless, or which come from the outside, but rather how we, in our personal development, deal with them. So the gooder we become, the more altruistic we become, the more these powers are used in an altruistic way. There's nothing wrong with money. Money is a great enabler. It's the use of money.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody who charges for services with the chief aim of making as much money as possible, is really developed to a degree which is very selfish and therefore powerful. So what I want to say is that we do have a great deal of self-empowerment. It's called will.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we know ourselves and these possibilities, which comes about through meditation, a really good psychotherapy, then the more we can use our will in the interest of humanity.
Yes, the whole idea of self-empowerment is very interesting, and the philosophy would say that, you know, coming to these rooms, we are volunteering and putting forth our interpretation of what the philosophy is. We are all students here. And if somebody comes and doesn't agree with everything, we're telling, you know, we put forth to test, check, and verify. We are not putting forth a dogma. We want people to be self-empowered, to have that will, to think about these things, and study and meditate and see what resonates with them. Yes?
Well, the word that just came to mind is inspiration. And we were thinking of those dedicated school teachers, military men who train young recruits to become men. They use a great deal of those higher psychic powers to inspire, to make the young ones feel I can do, and to paint pictures for them of what they could be. And could we say that that's the right use of psychic powers for the benefit, especially of younger people?
We think then that we're looking at motive. It's like why, and if somebody's being supportive and motivating to others, it doesn't necessarily have to be any specific group, but it could be anybody, it could be two friends. And we would think that not necessarily, again, we don't think that this is a psychic power as much as it might be somebody's intuition about what these people need. And knowing the reason why these people are here, if it's a specific group. So one needs to encourage in that respect, but we don't think it's really looking at it as being a psychic power. In the back?
Well, we're all impressionable because we all have a feeling nature. And the philosophy tells us that we color everything around us, not just people, the walls, the floor, the ceiling, the ground, the plants. We color and affect everything. Mm-hmm. And if we put our mind to it, we could color the day so beautifully that everything around us would move up just a little. And if everybody did that, we would change the world.
We think it was Abraham Lincoln made a comment that, what is it, we are happy as we make up our mind to be. And we really think that that's true. We can't, in these kinds of instances, we can't help but think about Helen Keller. I mean, she was incredible. I mean, she couldn't hear or speak.
Or see.
And she changed the world. And so we think in the idea of will was brought up, and we know that imagination, the kingly faculty, we know that is all karmic in how much you're going to be able to use it. But one person, we all, a lot of times we'll think, oh, I'm only one person, what can I do? But we know that one person can make a big difference. So we just want to make one last reading, and we'll end the meeting then. And this is from a master of wisdom. There is but one general law of life, but innumerable laws qualify and determine the myriad of forms perceived and of sounds heard. There are those who are willingly blind, mediums, and then there are those who are unwillingly blind, sensitives. Unless regularly initiated and trained, no self-tutored seer or clairaudient ever saw or heard quite correctly. So our meeting is over. Thank you.